You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume Number 27, by Dr. Rudolf Steiner and Dr. Ida Wegman, entitled Extending Practical Medicine, formerly known as Fundamentals of Therapy. This is the last chapter, chapter 20, entitled Typical Medicines. This has been translated by Anna Moise. And after this chapter, I will be adding a few addenda that are included at the end of the book, but I will let you know when the chapter is over first. Again, chapter 20, Typical Medicines, Introductory Remark. Below, a number of typical medicines we have partly put on the market will be described to show their medicinal value. They are designed for the treatment of typical diseases, and where typical aspects show themselves in a pathological state, our medicine must prove therapeutic in terms of what is presented in this book. A number of our medicines will be described from this point of view. 20.1 Scleron, spelled S-C-L-E-R-O-N. This consists of metallic lead, honey, and sugar. The action of lead on the organism is such that it encourages the destructive effects of the eye organization. If it is therefore introduced into an organism where the destructive effect of the eye organization is too little, encouragement results, providing the dosage is high enough. If the dose is too strong, hypertrophy of the eye organization occurs. The body destroys more than it creates and must fall into decay. In sclerosis, the eye organization is too weak. It does not itself show adequate destructive activity. Destruction is therefore effected by the astral body only. The products of degradation drop out of the organism and give extra strength to the organs which consist of salt substances. Lead, in suitable doses, restores destructive function to the eye organization. The products of degradation do not remain in the body and cause hardening, but are ejected. With sclerosis, the only possible way of effecting a cure is to open a channel to the outside for the salt-forming processes that otherwise remain in the body. With lead, we have given the processes of the eye organization direction. It is also necessary to keep these processes volatile, as it were. This is done by adding honey. Honey enables the eye organization to have proper control of the astral body. It thus removes the relative autonomy the astral body has in sclerosis. Sugar acts directly on the eye organization. It strengthens it in itself. Our medicine therefore achieves the following. Lead has a destructive action like that of the eye organization, and not like the astral body. Honey conveys the destructive activity of the astral body to the eye organization, and the sugar enables the eye organization to perform its specific function. It may be noted that the initial stages of sclerosis are evident from the fact that acuity of thought and exact control of memory cease. If our medicine is used at this early stage, it will be possible to avoid the more mature stages of sclerosis. It does, however, also prove effective at those later stages. Parenthesis, directions for use are given on the label. Close parenthesis. End of section 20.1. Section 20.2, Bidor for migraine. Bidor is spelled B-I-D-O-R. The head organization is such that the inner grayish-white part of the brain is physically the most advanced part of the human organization. It contains sensory activity, in which all the other senses are brought together, with the eye and the astral body acting into this. It takes an interest in the rhythmic system of the organism, which is influenced by the astral body and the ether body, and it also takes an interest, though only to a very slight degree, in the system of metabolism and limbs, which is influenced by the physical and ether body. This part of the brain differs from the peripheral brain enclosing it, which in its physical organization contains much more of the system of metabolism and limbs, a little more of the rhythmic system, but least of all of the system of nerves and senses. Migraine develops if an activity of the eye organization has been knocked back, so that the central brain has less neurosensory activity and more digestive activity. That is, gets more similar to the peripheral brain than it normally is. Its cure will therefore depend, number one, on stimulation of neurosensory activity. Number two, on a transformation of rhythmic activity from being inclined toward metabolism to being inclined toward respiration. Number three, on limiting the purely vital metabolic activity that lacks regulation by the eye organization. The first is achieved with silica. Silicon, combined with oxygen, contains processes that are like those which occur in the organism at the transition from respiratory to neurosensory activity. The second is achieved with sulfur. This contains the process by which the rhythm inclined toward the digestive system is changed into one inclined toward respiration. And the third is achieved with iron, which immediately after the digestive process of digestion channels metabolism into the process of the blood rhythm, which suppresses the metabolic process itself. Suitably processed iron, sulfur, and silica must therefore be a medicine for migraine. We have found this confirmed in countless cases. The end of section 20.2. Section 20.3, pyrites for tracheitis and bronchitis. We will now discuss a medicament that owes its existence to insight capable of establishing the right relationship of processes of substances to processes in the human organism. It has to be taken into account that a substance really is a process brought to a halt, a frozen process, as it were. We really should not speak of pyrites, but of the pyrites process. This process, held fast as though frozen in the mineral pyrites, is something that can arise when the iron process and the sulfur process act together. Iron stimulates the blood circulation, as mentioned in the section on Bidor, and sulfur mediates the connection between blood circulation and respiration. The origin of tracheitis and bronchitis, and also of some forms of stammer, lies in the very place where blood circulation and respiration enter into a relationship. This process between blood circulation and respiration, which is also the process out of which the organs concerned are developed in embryonic life and continue to be renewed as life goes on, can be taken over by iron-sulfur substance introduced into the body when it does not take its normal course in the organism. Based on this insight, we produce a medicament for the above pathology from pyrites. Reconfiguring the mineral in such a way that its forces find their way into the affected organs, where there is an internal indication. It is, of course, necessary to know the route particular substance processes take in the organism. The iron process is taken as far as the blood circulation by metabolism. The sulfur process moves from the blood circulation into the breathing process. The end of subsection 20.3. Section 20.4, Actions of Antimony Compounds. Antimony has an extraordinarily powerful connection with other solids, for example, sulfur. It thus shows us that it can easily follow the route which sulfur takes in the organism, for example, to all respiratory processes. Another property of antimony is that it tends to crystallize in radiating masses. It thus shows us that it easily follows specific energy radiations in the Earth's environment. This property is even more evident if antimony is subjected to the process of liquation. This makes it finely fibrous. And it shows itself even more significantly if antimony is taken through a combustion process and its white vapor develops. This vapor deposits on cold solids to produce the characteristic antimony bloom. Just as antimony follows the forces acting on it when outside the human organism, so it follows the form-generating forces when in the human organism. In the blood, we have, as it were, a state of balance between form-generating and form-dissolving forces. Antimony is able, because of the above-mentioned properties, to take the form-generating forces of the human organism into the blood, providing the way is prepared through combination with sulfur. The powers of antimony are thus the ones at work in the coagulation of the blood. In terms of the science of the spirit, the situation is that the astral body is strengthened in the powers that lead to coagulation of the blood. One has to see forces similar to those of antimony in the astral body that act centrifugally from the inside to the outside. Against these antimonizing forces act the forces that go from the outside to the inside, liquefying the blood and putting liquefied blood as a plastic principle at the service of body development. The forces of protein also work in this direction. The forces contained in the protein process continually prevent the coagulation of the blood. Take the case of typhoid fever. It is a preponderance of albuminizing forces. By introducing antimony into the organism in extremely subtle doses, one acts against the forces that create typhoid fever. It must be taken into account, however, that the action of antimony is very different, depending on whether it is used internally or externally. With external application, in ointments and the like, it weakens the centrifugal forces of the astral body that come to expression in eczematous changes, for instance. With internal use, it opposes the forces that are too powerfully centripetal, as seen in the case of typhoid fever. Antimony is an important medicament in all conditions where consciousness is dimmed to a dangerous degree, somnolence. In this case, the form-giving, centrifugal forces of the astral body, and hence the brain and sensory processes, have been partly put out of action. If antimony is introduced into the organism, the missing astral forces are artificially created. It will always be found that taking antimony strengthens memory, enhances the creative powers of the soul and makes the state of soul more complete in itself. The organism is regenerated in a process that comes from the strengthened soul. An awareness of this existed in earlier times in medicine. Antimony was therefore a universal remedy for physicians of old. We may not take such an extreme position, but in view of the above, we must nevertheless seek to consider antimony as a medicine that has many uses. End of section 20.4. Section 20.5, cinnabar. We were able to perceive cinnabar to be an important medicinal agent. This is a substance where we have the opportunity to study the relationship of mercury to the human organism, a relationship that has been defended by many and challenged by many. Mercury is the frozen process which is right in the midst of the regenerative processes that within the organism separate the organism's essential nature off almost completely from itself. The mercury forces characteristically cause these separated off forces to be absorbed again in the whole organism. Mercury may thus be clinically used in extremely subtle doses, where processes develop in the organism that separate themselves from it and need to be brought under the control of the organism as a whole again. These are all catarrhal processes. They develop when external influences cause some tract of the organism to be wrested away from the control of the organism as a whole. This is the case with tracheitis and all catarrhal changes in that area. Mercury forces are medicinal if directed toward them. One property of sulfur that has been mentioned a number of times is that it is effective in the area of the organism where circulation and respiration meet, that is, in everything that comes from the lung. Cinnabar is a compound of mercury and sulfur. It is an effective medicament for all catarrhal changes in the above-mentioned areas of the human organism. The end of section 20.5, and this is the last section of the book, of chapter 20 and of the book. Subsection 20.6, Gensaido as a hay fever medicine. The symptoms of hay fever are inflammatory changes in the mucosa of eyes, nose, throat, and upper respiratory passages. The history of patients suffering from hay fever often shows that disease processes coming under the heading of quote, exudative diathesis, close quote, occurred also in childhood. This points to the ether body and the way the astral body behaves. The forces of the ether body preponderate, and the astral body withdraws, showing a tendency not to intervene properly in the etheric and physical body. Catarrhal symptoms arise when the orderly intervention of the astral body, and hence also the eye organization, in the affected areas is disturbed. Astral body and eye organization become hypersensitive, and this also explains the spasmodic attacks of reactions to sensory impressions such as light, heat, cold, dust, and the like. The healing process must therefore address the astral body, helping it to intervene in the proper way in the etheric body. This is possible if we use fruit juice from fruits with leathery skins. It is immediately apparent, if one looks at these fruits, that configuring principles acting inward from the outside are particularly active in them. Giving such juices internally and applying then externally, we achieve stimulation of the astral body in a direction going toward the ether body. Their mineral constituents, such as potassium, calcium, and silica, will at the same time cause support to be given by the eye organization, parentheses see chapter 17, close parentheses, so that one achieves genuine healing of the hay fever. Detailed directions for use are included with the product. That is the end of subsection 20.6, the end of chapter 20, technically the end of the book. I am now adding some addenda. The first one is earlier editions. Below are the preface and postscript Dr. Wegmann wrote for the earlier editions of this work. Preface to the first edition. Our teacher, leader, and friend Rudolf Steiner is no longer among the living. A serious illness which arose from physical exhaustion has taken him from us. He had to take to his bed when still fully engaged in his work, and his energies, which he had given in such great measure, never holding back, to his work in the Anthroposophical Society, were no longer sufficient to overcome the illness. All who loved and revered him had to experience in great pain that this human being, someone who had been able to help so many people, had to let destiny take its course where he himself was concerned, knowing full well that higher powers prevailed in this case. The fruit of our common efforts is presented in this small volume. The teachings of Anthroposophy, which for medical science in particular is a gold mine of new ideas, were something I, as a physician, could fully accept, finding in them a source of wisdom on which it was possible to draw ever and always, and which can illumine and solve many problems that are still unsolved today. And so active cooperation developed between Rudolf Steiner and myself, deepening to such a degree, especially in the last 2 years, that it proved possible to write and produce a book between us. It had always been Rudolf Steiner's desire, and I was able to understand this fully, to renew the mysteries of old and let them enter into medicine. For those mysteries have from time immemorial been closely connected with the skills of healing, with the gaining of spiritual insights considered important in healing work. The aim was not to underestimate scientific medicine in an amateurish way. It was given full recognition. But it was important to add to existing knowledge the insights that can come from true perception of the spirit, enabling us to understand the processes of illness and healing. Of course, the intention was not to bring the inward instinctive ways of the ancient mysteries back to life, but to find a way that was in accord with the fully developed modern conscious mind, taking it up into the sphere of the spirit. Thus, a beginning was made. An institute of clinical medicine I had established in Arlesheim provided the practical background for the theories presented in this book. And we sought to show ways in the art of healing that seek to find an extension of medical knowledge along the lines indicated here. We intended to follow this small volume with many things arising from our common work. Sadly, this was no longer possible. I intend, however, to follow this volume with a second, perhaps even a third, based on the many suggestions and notes in my possession. May this first volume, the manuscript of which was corrected by Rudolf Steiner with pleasure and inner satisfaction, just 3 days before his death, find its way to all who seek to find a way from the riddles of life to an understanding of life in its glory and greatness. Arlesheim, Dornach, September 1925, Ida Wegmann, M.D. Postscript. Up to this point, we have had the fruit of our shared work, and surely much regretted by all of us, writing had to cease when Rudolf Steiner's illness began. The plan had been to discuss in the continuation the earthly and cosmic forces active in the metals, gold, silver, lead, iron, copper, mercury, and tin, and to consider how they may be used in medicine. We also intended to show the deep insights people possessed in the ancient mysteries into the relationships between these metals and the planets, and their relationships to the different organs in the human organism. The intention was to speak of this knowledge and give it a new foundation. My work in the immediate future will be to let the second part of the book appear soon, based on suggestions made to me and on my notes. End of postscript. Editorial notes from the publishers of the German, in Dornach, the present edition, Origin, first edition, 1925. From the seventh German edition, 1991 onward, the text was compared with the first edition and corrected as required. Editorial changes made in the text compared to the first edition are listed below. This book was written by Rudolf Steiner and Ida Wegmann. Chapters 1 through 18 are in Rudolf Steiner's handwriting, chapters 19 and 20 in Ida Wegmann's. The manuscript prepared for press is almost completely preserved. All that is missing are the title pages, the preface, postscript, and paragraph 6 in chapter 20. The manuscript and the printed text differ in places, because 3 days before his death, Rudolf Steiner still made numerous corrections and additions to the galley proofs. After Rudolf Steiner's death, the editing and implementation of these corrections were taken care of by Dr. Hilma Walter. Ida Wegmann wrote a preface and a postscript. The book was published in September 1925. The proposed second and perhaps even third volume never appeared. To continue the work, Ida Wegmann published various items in the supplement to the journal titled Natura for members of the medical section in 1926 to 1931, based on suggestions and notes deriving from her work with Rudolf Steiner. She published further medical essays in the journal Natura itself between 1926 and 1932. These have been combined and published under the title Im Anbruch des Wirkens für eine Erweiterung der Heilkunst nach geisteswissenschaftlicher Menschenkunde, Alesheim Natura Verlag, 1956. Part of Rudolf Steiner's manuscript has been printed in facsimile entitled Beiträge zu Rudolf Steiner Gesamtausgabe, Nummer 5859, Dornach, Herbst, 1977, S3-21. Substantial editorial changes compared to the 1925 edition are the following. Compared to G. Adams and partly E. A. Frommer's and J. Josephson's translations. And there's just a few here I'm not going to... Well, I'll read them. Title page, the words Part 1 that followed the title have been omitted since the second edition. Contents, the heading Contents, was followed by the subtitle Part 1. This has been omitted since the third edition. Page 40, line 14, hem, H-A-E-M, to replace hematin, H-A-E-M-A-T-I-N. Page 77, line 25, protein synthesis to replace protein activities. Page 111, line 5, quote, in the nettle, close quote, to replace, quote, in the influence of the nettle. Close quote. Page 114, line 28, quote, after the process of digestion, close quote, to replace, quote, after metabolism, close quote, or, quote, after the digestive process, close quote. Page 114, line 31, quote, suitably processed, close quote, to replace, quote, properly combined and administered, close quote, or, quote, in an appropriate form, close quote. And then finally, the last thing here is a translator's note. This being a written work with the proofs of the original German edition checked by Rudolf Steiner himself, it seemed important to adhere as closely as possible to the original text. This did not prove too difficult a task on the whole, as the sentences are generally short and positively succinct, thesis following thesis, as it were. The division into sentences, with use of full stops and semicolons, has been followed exactly, as the division into paragraphs. including the unusual method of subdividing a paragraph by having a dash between two sentences. Some problems arose with consistency of terminology. An example is the following. Rudolf Steiner and Ida Wegmann used four terms to cover separating, secretory, and eliminatory processes, and it seemed important to be consistent in the use of all four English terms to match these. Two of the German terms, used both as verbs and verbal nouns, are absondern and aussondern, used once only. As the simplex, sondern relates well to the English sunder. These two have been translated as separate off and separate out. The other pair, abscheiden and ausscheiden, have the simplex scheiden, which is an older term for separate, parenthesis today largely superseded by trennen, close parenthesis, still used especially in chemistry and medicine. Here I have used the standard present-day terms for abscheiden, to secrete, and ausscheiden, to eliminate. Maintaining this consistency has not always been easy. The terms would work well at times, but could also be problematical. Parenthesis see title of chapter 12, close parenthesis. Translating decisions were taken in full recognition of the fundamental and germinal nature of this work. Written at Surbiton, July 1996, by Anna Moise, and that is the end of the book, Extending Practical Medicine, formerly known as Fundamentals of Therapy, by Dr. Rudolf Steiner and Dr. Ida Wegmann, Collected Works, Volume 27.